Good afternoon, everyone. My name's Debbie King. I'm Head of Infection Prevention at Solihull Care Trust in England. It's my great pleasure to host today's teleclass presented to you courtesy of Weber Training, today's speaker being Professor Judith Tanner. Professor Tanner is a former theatre nurse who started her current post, a joint post between the university and the hospital, in 2006. Judith's research interests are around clinical practices which impact on surgical site infections, and it's with great pleasure that I welcome Judith Tanner to join us today and to make her presentation, Post-Discharge Surgical Site Surveillance Made Easy.
Well, thank you very much, Debbie. Thank you for a lovely introduction. And I've got to say, I'm really excited about doing this kind of presentation because I have never done it before, and it's a really exciting new development. So, before we start talking about post-discharge surveillance, I'd like to begin by convincing you why we should do post-discharge surveillance. And it's because the current rates of surgical site infections, which are based on inpatient and readmission data, are hugely underestimated. And because the rates are underestimated, then people underestimate the importance of surgical site infection, and they also and the need to reduce infection rates and implement best practice is not given the priority that it deserves. If you want to change practice, you have to show practitioners how common surgical site infections are, and you won't do that if you're basing your argument on underestimated inpatient-only data. So, for example, I've just got an article here that I read just last week, and it's in a well-respected journal. Now, let me just read you the very first line from this article, okay? In the summary, the abstract bit, it says, the risk of surgical site infection is approximately 1% for elective clean surgery. Now, 1%? One patient out of 100? I've got to be honest with you and say that I don't think that's a bad rate. If I was a theatre manager and you asked me if I would buy some new equipment for you which would reduce your surgical site infections and it had a cost implication, to treat only one patient in 100 patients, the chances are that I might say no and refuse to buy that for you. So with that in mind, let's look at my first slide. There we go. Right. This is the national data from the UK, from the Health Protection Agency, and that's the government organisation that collects SSI data. The HPA have the same role in the UK that the CDC does in America. Now, these are the SSI rates for 2007 to 2008. Now, the 2008 to 2009 rates have just been published, but they're in a graph format, so it's not easy to see exactly what the figures are. So I've just published these ones because it's easier to see, you know, the exact figures. But the latest, last year's figures are not that different. Perhaps the large bowel has the greatest difference, and it's gone from 8% up to just over 10%. But again, if you look at these SSI rates, you know, 2%, 3%, they're not really, you might say, they're not really that bad. So, you know, you might not persuade people to change their practice based on these figures. So I want you to keep those kind of figures in the back of your mind, because we might come back to them during the presentation. So let me tell you, let's move on to the next slide, and I'll tell you what happened at our trust. In December 2007, our lead nurse for tissue viability came to the senior nurse for surgery, and she said, what's happening in your colorectal theatres? What's going on? She said, because I'm in charge of the VAC dressings, the negative pressure topical dressings. She said, I'm in charge of those vacuum dressings, and my budget has gone through the roof. We're using loads of them. Is there something happening in your theatre? Have you got some sort of infection problem? Is there some outbreak? Is something going on? And the nurse for surgery, the head nurse for surgery, had to say, you know, I don't know. I do not know, because we're not part of any of the voluntary government, the HPA surveillance program. We don't have any surveillance program on our own. So the surgeons haven't said anything. So I'm not aware of any problems in our theatre. But let's have an opportunity. Let's take this opportunity. We'll get a team together of people who are kind of interested or will have some impact, and we're going to do some surveillance. We're going to do some proper gold standard surveillance, because if you want to do something, then there's no point in being half-hearted and only looking at half the picture. Let's look at the whole thing and do it properly. So on that picture of the slide, there's some of the people who were involved in the team there, and you can see they've come from the surgery, the tissue viability, the ward sister who did the surveillance, who we seconded her to do the surveillance program, and infection control team. Right, and actually on our next slide here, you can see one of our colorectal patients from last year. So these are the kind of patients we were very concerned about. So let me tell you about the surveillance program. That's on the next slide. We started it in January 2008, and we carried through for 3 months into April, and we recruited all the patients who were operated on during that time. And then we carried through into May, an extra 30 days to follow up, you know, the very last of those patients. So it ran for 5 months in the first half 2008. Now, we did it in colorectal surgery because that's where we were concerned with. And we said, well, colorectal surgery is kind of at one end of the SSI spectrum. So let's do something clean. And we said, this is a good opportunity. Let's do it in primary breast surgery as well. And we're very specific when we looked at the types of procedures. We were very specific about the procedures that we wanted to look at within those specialties. So with colorectal, it was anterior resection, AP resection, hemicolectomy, those kind of things. And then breast surgery was wide local excision, that sort of thing. So because different procedures have got different surgical site infection rates, and you don't want to compare apples and pears, so we're very specific about the procedures that we looked at. We were very strict about our definitions. The definition for surgical site infection, we used the HPA-1, the HPA definition, which is modified from the CDC definition in that the one where it says it's an infection because the healthcare professional says it is, we scrapped that one and we didn't use that as a judgment. So we used the SSI definitions, and we were very conscious that at the end of the surveillance program, we would be presenting our findings to the surgical team and, you know, wider within the hospital, and we wanted it to be flawless. We did not want any surgeon to say, well, you've died, you know, this isn't the correct definition of such and such, therefore all your findings are invalid. So we produced a protocol which was about 20 pages long, and we defined every single term that we used in our database. You know, so what was emergency surgery? What was elective surgery? Everything had a very strict definition. And that meant that was really helpful for us later on in the study when we were trying to convince people of the findings. What else did we do? We had a surveillance nurse. Now, this was a dedicated surveillance nurse, and this was really important because, to begin with, she was independent. So it wasn't one of the surgeons looking at his own data, right? And it wasn't a member of the, it wasn't, you know, for example, one of the infection control team nurses who was given an additional task. This was a ward nurse who we seconded for the study just purely to look at the in the surgical site surveillance program. And she was given some training with the infection control team and also the tissue viability nurses and the surgeons to so that she was able to clarify exactly what was infected and what was not infected by looking at wounds, because that's, you know, potentially quite tricky. We had the full 30-day follow-up as recommended by the CDC. And what we did was Caroline, our surveillance nurse, she telephoned the patients on day 10, day 20, and day 30. And we thought that was the best thing, because if you phone somebody on day 30 and you ask them what happened, during that 30 days previously, you know, it's sometimes a bit difficult to remember. So if we did it three times, then the chances of them forgetting or not being quite sure was, that was eliminated. And when Caroline phoned them, she used a validated questionnaire, which, for example, went through all the signs and symptoms of infection. You know, is it red? Is it hot? Is it swollen? Is there anything leaking out of the wound? She went through all of those questions. And then finally, at the very end, it said, do you think you have an infection? Now, we kind of ignored the question that says, do you have an infection? Because the studies show that patients are very good at seeing, at recognizing their symptoms, so they can tell if something's red and if it's swollen and if it's sore. But if you say, do you think you've got an infection? They go, oh no, right? So what we did was, when Caroline read out the questions to them, and if they said yes to any of those symptoms, like it was red or swollen or oozing, then Caroline would go and she would visit that patient at home. Or if the patient was coming in for an outpatient appointment or something in the next couple of days, then she would meet up and liaise with them there. So we ultimately used direct observation, and Caroline would confirm or reject the presence of an infection. So let me show you what we found then. So on the next slide, these are the findings for the colorectal surgery. So during that 4 months during the 4 months while we were doing surgery, we had a total of 126 colorectal patients. And we lost, well, 21 of them were excluded from the surveillance, and that's a standard surveillance protocol, you know, inclusion criteria or exclusion criteria. So 8 were lost to follow-up, 6 died, and 7 had further surgery. So with those patients, you can't be sure if the infection was from the first operation or the second operation. So they were excluded. So during that time period of 4 months, we had 105 patients which were included in the surveillance. Now, before we go on and look at the next slide, I want to think back to that national data, which said that for large bowel surgery, the national surveillance surgical site infection rate was 8% in 2007, and it was 10% in 2008 when we were doing the study. So 10% was what was happening nationally at the time. Right, flick onto the next slide, and there you'll see our infection rate. So during that four-month period, 29 infections gave us a 27% infection rate. So that's practically 1 in 3 of our patients had a surgical site infection. So that's practically three times the national data. Now, remember that the national data was just inpatients and readmissions. Now, if we'd looked at our inpatients and readmissions figures only, we had 17 patients diagnosed as inpatients and 3 as readmissions, which would have given us 19% as our infection rate, which is still a lot higher than the national data. But to explain for that, the way in which we collected our data was very, you know, it was rigorous, it was thorough. We had a dedicated post, so a dedicated surveillance nurse, so not somebody doing this on top of something else. We did not use patients, we did not rely on patient self-reporting, because remember I said that they tend to underestimate, if you say, have you got an infection, they underestimate. And we weren't relying on just looking at the patient's notes. So we were very thorough, very rigorous in the way that we collected the data. So it was real active surveillance, which is why this was higher, coming up with much higher figures than the national data suggested. Now, just in case there's anybody out there who thinks that at Leicester, where the hospital where we conducted the survey, in case you're thinking at Leicester, well, perhaps they're actually just a lot worse at Leicester, right? Because we have had our moments, but this wasn't one of them. But let me tell you that there are, we did a literature search, and we managed to find 3 other surveillance programs in colorectal surgery looking at the same procedures, which also used gold standard surveillance. So it was also the 30-day follow-up with telephone calls and direct observations. We found 3 studies, all carried out in the States, and the findings or the infection rates that they found for colorectal surgery was 20%, 22%, and 26%. So that really validates the our study as being probably a more accurate representation of what surgical site infection rates are in colorectal surgery than the kind of national surveillance programs, which primarily are, they're not, you know, as active as we were, and they're inpatient and readmissions. Now, if we have a look at the next slide, just to pick up on a couple of things, you actually see there the very first one, we actually had quite a high deep infection rate, which is kind of interesting, so it's something we need to deal with at our hospital. But the next thing down, presenting infection, okay, the number of days till the infection presented. Now, look at that, 13 days average. Now, when I speak to nurses and we say, what do you think, you know, when do you think infections present, they say, oh, between 3 to 6 days, right? And that seems to be kind of a common perception. But that information, that 3 to 6 days, is based on inpatient data. So the average is obviously going to be shorter than the average inpatient stay. Now, the longer you follow up a patient for, the longer that duration, you know, the longer the day will be before the infections present. We were still picking up infections presenting on day 29 of our surveillance. And there are other studies, if you look at them, that have gone on for 45 days. And if you look at when the infections present on those studies, you'll see they're still, you know, they're tailing off, but they're still presenting very late on in the surveillance follow-up period. Now, you might think that that's just a theoretical point and it doesn't really have that much impact on practice, but in December, just you know, a couple of months ago, in December, I'm doing another surveillance program like this, but in a different hospital, and we're doing it on patients who've had vasectomies. Now, there was one of the gentlemen, he had had his 10-day follow-up phone call. So they'd gone through all the questions, is it red, is it swollen, blah, blah, blah. And he'd said no to all of those questions. So the nurse said, okay, thank you very much, and I'll phone you again on day 20 and see how you're getting on. On day 13, the chap woke up and his scrotum was swollen, it was red, and it was sore. So he phoned the hospital, right, and got through to a nurse, and he described his symptoms, and the nurse said to him, she said, when did you have your surgery? And he said, 13 days ago. And she said, oh, well, if you've had your surgery 2 weeks previous, then this is too late to have a surgical site infection, because surgical site infections present 3 to 6 days after the procedure. So this won't be a surgical site infection. So just go back to bed and elevate your feet. Now, the man was admitted to hospital a couple of days later and had to go into ITU. So you can see that the perceptions surrounding this, based on inpatient data, are perhaps erroneous. So that was an interesting one with the days of presentation. What else we can look at? We can look at post-discharge. You can see the split here, 17 inpatients and post-discharge. We had 12 patients diagnosed after discharge, and 3 of those were readmissions. And this kind of highlights an assumption that people make when we're working in the acute care, when we're working in theatres, is that if patients have got an infection, they'll come back to the hospital. And that really is an assumption, and that certainly isn't happening. And we've seen this, you know, when we've been speaking with GPs and other surgeons, they've sort of verified this. There are lots of patients who are in the community who have infections that don't come back to the hospital, and we never see them again, and we just don't know about these patients. So this kind of emphasizes the need to do post-discharge surveillance. Our length of stay there, you can see the figures are actually quite high for length of stay anyway, but you can see that the infected patients were 8 days longer, which is, you know, quite a lot awful for the patients and also costly. Risk factors. What we did while we had Caroline doing the surveillance, we had a huge database, and we had perhaps about 100 different fields. So we knew who all the surgeons were, who the circulating nurses were, which theatre, which hospital. We have 3 hospitals on our site. Which prep solution did they have? All sorts of things that were relating to the surgery. There was about 100 different things about the patient and the surgery and their pre-admission and their post-discharge. All sorts of factors. And then at the end of the surveillance program, we involved the statistician, and we did some correlations to see what stood out as being anything common amongst the patients who had surgical site infections. Now, you have to remember that we only had 105 patients, so it's not a huge sample to do analysis, which might be why we only got one significant risk factor coming out, and that was having patients who had a high body mass index. So that's that shows us that in our hospital and in colorectal surgery, body mass index was a big issue. But what was interesting was while a high BMI was statistically significant, a very low BMI was also showing as a trend. And what that was saying to us then, it kind of flashed up nutrition. So it makes us think about nutrition when we're now looking at admitting new patients in for surgery. Okay. On the next slide, the one about compliance. Now, this was kind of an extra finding. It wasn't something we'd set out to look at, but it was something that was actually a part of the surveillance, and it was actually quite a useful thing for us to identify. Remember I said that we had all these different data fields? Well, one of them was whether or not the patients had a Stelacept body wash. This is what all patients in our hostel have prior to surgery. They have the wash with this antiseptic solution. Now, I know the guidelines say don't do it, but we like it in our hospital, and we're sticking to it, okay? But what was interesting is, at the time of our surveillance program, because there was an audit. Now, you know, we have audits going on all the time in the hospital, but these two were going on simultaneously. Now, what was interesting, the audit, which was conducted by the ward staff to find out about patient compliance with the Stelacept washes, this is about the nurses giving the patients the Stelacept washes, or, you know, giving them the lotion and telling them to go into the shower. Interestingly, the ward audit showed 100% compliance with the Stelacept washes, whereas our database showed 60% compliance, and that was that data was generated by Caroline going around asking the patients, did you have your wash this morning? And looking in the patient's notes to find a sticker, because they get a sticker stuck in there to show that they've had the Stelcept wash. So that was interesting to see the differences between the two different kind of audits. So that was useful for future practice. Preoperative hair removal, we were surprised to see that we have patients who are still being shaved preoperatively with a razor, which meant that we have now changed our practice because we actually have clippers in our hospital, but the staff weren't using them and they were just using razors instead. So we were able to do something about that. Prophylactic antibiotics. Now, this was at the time, 2008 was at the time where C. diff, there were big problems in the UK, and certainly at Leicester, at my own trust, we had big problems with C. diff. And as a result of that, we had implemented very strict antibiotic prescribing policies. And in spite of those, it was interesting to see that our colorectal patients, when we looked at the prophylactic antibiotics they were given, there were still 14 different combinations of drugs that were given as prophylaxis. And that certainly wasn't in line with the hospital policy. So that was interesting to see that. The next thing that we picked up on was when the antibiotics were given. And remember, we had 105 patients. Now, out of that 105 patients, 8 did not get any antibiotics at all. Now, remember, we're meant to give prophylactic antibiotics at the start of this procedure. 8 did not get any at all, and 6 were given late, and that was up to 4 hours after knife to skin. Now, what was interesting, though, was that there was no relationship between the patients who didn't get antibiotics and the patients who had late antibiotics with surgical site infection. But that might just be that our sample size was too small. Okay, but that was an interesting thing to notice. And then the last thing I've got on this slide here is the vacuum-assisted closure dressings, VAC dressings. Now, this was really interesting because what was happening at the time, if you're familiar with organizing or arranging the VAC dressings, when the tissue viability or the surgical team say this patient needs a VAC dressing, the VAC dressing then has to be organized, and it's not something that we just have spare in a cupboard. You have to set up a contract and get it's quite not bureaucratic, but it's a slowish process. Now, at the time, I think there was a sort of a problem with some of the suppliers at the time, and it meant that we would have a patient who was ready for to be discharged, okay, so they didn't clinically need to be in the hospital, but we were waiting to have a VAC dressing applied to that patient, and we like to get the tissue viability team, like to get the VAC dressings all set up and organized before the patient's discharged to the community. And what was happening was there was a delay in getting the VAC dressings. So we had a few patients who were kept in hospital for an extra night so they could get the VAC dressing applied when it arrived the next day, right? Now, what was interesting then was when we were following up the patients, we were looking at their dressings, and in those 105 patients, 16 of them had a VAC dressing applied. And of those 16 VAC dressings, four of them, a quarter of them, roughly, four of them were removed within 24 to 48 hours when the patient got to the community. And the reasons the community nurses gave for that was that they weren't quite familiar with how to manage the dressings, and they swapped the VAC dressings for a more traditional Sorbsan kind of dressing. So that was interesting because especially our tissue viability team in the hospital, when they put on a VAC dressing, they liaise with the community tissue viability nurses or the community practice nurses to say, are you happy for us to put a VAC dressing on? But because there's so many people rotating and at night, you don't always get the staff who are familiar with how to manage VAC dressings. So that was an interesting point for us that we weren't really aware of. The next slide, I've got the specimens that we isolated from the bacteria that we isolated from the patients. And as you can see, it's a bit of a mix. The good news was that we had no patients with MRSA. Now, remember, we do our Stelocept washes for all patients prior to surgery, but whether that had an impact or not, this was prior to screening, okay? We had one case of C. diff, and you can see there that there are some strep cases. Now, we investigated those strep cases, and there was no link between them. So they were different theatres, different staff. There was no link there. Now, the next thing we looked at on the next slide, the next thing we looked at was the cost, because It's a bit difficult to find out how much infections cost. There are not that many studies around. Some of, you know, what is there can be a bit old. And there's a lot of estimates going on. So what we did, we looked at the exact cost. And Caroline, when she followed up every patient, she looked at every resource that was used by each patient, okay? So she looked at how many additional nights stay did they have, how many district nurse visits did they have the half-hour visit at £36, or did they have the full hour at £58, how many dressing changes did they have, what kind of dressing was it, which brand, everything, every resource we could think of to do with the hospital or the primary care trust, we documented that. Now, we didn't look at the cost to the patient, which is a real shame. It had been fantastically interesting, but we just didn't have the time to do that. So we were concentrating on the cost to the NHS. And what we came up with was something which we called the additional cost. When the primary care trust buy colorectal operations from the acute trust, they kind of pay for a package, right, an all-in package, and you get the surgery, so many nights stay, you get two district nurse visits and a GP visit, and that kind of, so that's your package. And what we were looking at was what was extra, what was on top of that, right? So what was the cost of treating the infection? So if you want to move to the next slide, this has got a chart here of what we found. And you can see we've split that up into inpatient, so acute care costs, and then the costs which were after discharge, so the primary care costs. And so this is for 4 months' worth of surgery, okay? So this is for our 29 patients who were infected during those 4 months' worth of operating. And you can see their total cost for those patients is just over 300,000. Now, remember, that's the additional cost. So we're not talking about the cost of the surgery, the additional cost of the infections. And you can see that per patient, that's just £10,500 for each patient, additional cost. Now, what's interesting, which is quite a lot, right? And what you can also see here is when we've split it up into the primary care costs and also the acute costs, that the PCT, Primary Care Trust, they were taking up, they were footing 15% of the bill. Now, our primary care trust were not really quite aware of this because of the way they organise their, you know, their district nurse services practice and their practice nurses. They weren't quite aware that they were spending this amount of money on looking after infected colorectal patients. And whether this was what the impetus was, but we have targets called sequin targets in the UK, and which is the primary care trust imposes, the commissioning trust imposes on the acute care trusts. And interestingly, we now have targets within our sequin for to implement surgical site infection surveillance programs and also to reduce our surgical site infections. And that's imposed upon us by the primary care trusts. Okay, so let me just refresh this slide again. So we're looking at over 4 months of operating, just over £300,000. Now the next slide, this is what we did. We then said, okay, if that's what it cost us in 4 months, and which was a pretty average, you know, kind of run of patients for us, that we weren't doing lots more than normal, or that we didn't appear to have any different problems that we didn't usually have, if you know what I mean. So we said, let's multiply this by 3 and let's find out what we're costing for 1 year. So this is what we said. So one year projection, 12 months, it was just under £1 million, just under £1 million. And this is the additional cost, okay? Not the basic package, not the surgery. This is the additional cost of treating the infections. And remember that these patients were also then taking up beds and preventing us from operating on other patients so we could get income generation. So just under £1 million, and this is when and that's just for one surgical specialty. Now in our hospital, we've got about 12 or 13 surgical specialties, and admittedly, you know, colorectal surgery is probably one of the more expensive in terms of infections, but it's still, that's a lot of money just when we've got all the other ones we haven't even thought about yet. And this, when we presented this data to the trust board, this is where the chief exec really sat up and took notice.
Okay.
Now, people say post-discharge surveillance, they say we don't do it because it is prohibitively expensive. So I want you to look at the next slide. because we were bearing that in mind. Everybody says it's difficult to do and it's really expensive. So what we did was we got Caroline to do a workload analysis of everything that she did each day, splitting it up so we could see what kind of tasks she was doing. And we also looked at what the costs involved were. Now, we had Caroline for 5 months, and she did two surveillance programs. She did colorectal half of the week. You know, she split her week, split it up, I think mornings and afternoons or something, but colorectal half the time and breast surgery the other half. So for one surgical specialty, we had Caroline half time, so 18 and a half hours a week. And Caroline was a band 5 nurse. I'm trying to think what that is. That's a salary of about, I think, maybe about 28,000, I think. So we had the cost of Caroline. The travel visits were actually remarkably small. They were low cost there, and that's mainly because Caroline was able to catch up with patients when they came into the hospital for other things. Phone calls, a lot of phone calls, that was cheap. The statistician was relatively cheap. The database didn't cost us anything. So you can see for that, to have Caroline conducting the program part-time to look at one surgical specialty for 5 months, but to do it, you know, really rigorously, really thoroughly, was just over £5,000. That's not a lot of money. And when Caroline did the workload analysis, when we looked at what she did, a lot of it did not require any clinical intervention. So it was reading notes, talking to patients, getting data from patients, data extraction, looking at data, you know, the hospital databases and things. The only time that she needed clinical judgment was when she was looking at a wound, right? So it then meant, it said to us then, when we employ more surveillance nurses, we do not need to employ nurses at band 5. So what we have done, because when our chief exec saw the figures and what it was costing, he asked us to set up a surveillance program, and the new surveillance staff that we've employed are band 3. Now, in the UK, we call them healthcare assistants. So they're band 3 healthcare assistants. Now, admittedly, they do need quite a lot of training to set them up and get them started because, for example, while nurses can just, you know, can read notes, our healthcare assistants, our band 3s, weren't familiar with looking at the patient's notes. So we had to give them some tutorials in going through those. So they did need a lot more input. And when it comes, and what we've done is with those, the band 3 HCAs, when we're getting them to look at the infections, they're not doing that on their own. We'll liaise, they liaise with the infection control team so that the head of their service, the infection control nurse, goes out with them and looks at does a direct observation. So what I'm saying here, though, is that it doesn't even need to be as expensive as £5,000. You can come down a few grades in your staffing levels and have a cheaper band 3 healthcare assistant. And there are other advantages for having that because Caroline, she was working as a staff nurse at the time, and she's now a sister, which is fantastic, so she's been promoted. But she said she could do it for 5 months, but after that she said, I'm bored, right? I loved it. It was brilliant, fantastic experience, and I've learned a lot, but I do not want to do this forever and ever. Whereas if we're our band 3 HCAs, they see this as a career move for them, right? Now, that's not some... So whereas a surveillance nurse doing the data collection probably would not see HPA surveillance as a career move, and there might be some job dissatisfaction and they want to move around and you're losing your consistency and you've trained somebody up and then they go. Whereas with your band 3 HCAs, for them, it's a career move, and they're much more likely to have good job satisfaction and more likely to stay in post, which is good news for everyone. So, okay, let's move on to the next section of the presentation, which was about the breast surgery. Now, what we were looking at was mastectomies and wide local excisions. And we've kind of gone from the other extreme, you know, the other extreme, because we're looking at colorectal surgery, which is kind of clean contaminated, but not, you know, and down to elective and predominantly elective clean surgery. So we did this at exactly the same time. So again, it was January through to April and then following up for the month of May. And during that time, we were operated on 200 patients. And we had to exclude 41 of them because 23 lost to follow-up and 18 had further surgery, which left us with 159 included in the surveillance. Now, breast surgery is not included in our HPA National Data Collection Surveillance Program, so we don't have any data from the HPA, but the clean surgery is estimated to be around 2%, okay? So let me show you what we found. So on the next slide, here we go. Findings, breast surgery, SSIs. 16 patients had developed an SSI, which gave us 10%. So 10%, every 1 in 10 of our women had developed a surgical site infection. And again, just in case you think that it's just us at Leicester having dirty habits, there was a large study published in Scotland which also had a 30-day follow-up, and they also showed a 10% infection rate in breast surgery, primary breast surgery. Let's look at some more details. Move on to the next slide. Now, this is an interesting thing. Also, 13 days presentation of infection, same as colorectal surgery. So that was kind of interesting. You can see here the distribution of where we detected the SSIs, whether they were inpatient or post-discharge or readmissions. And you can see if we had used the government national surveillance data method of using inpatients and readmissions, those 2 patients and the 5 patients, that would have given us a 4% infection rate. So which would have looked a lot better than 10%, but it was still 4%. Remember, we're quite rigorous in the way we collect the data. Now, what's interesting here is that we've got more risk factors were identified. Now, that might be because it's a slightly larger sample, 160 patients compared to 105. I'm not sure, but What was kind of saddening was that if you look at the first 2 there, smoking and body mass index, both of those are kind of intrinsic to the patient. And you almost feel that when you're working in acute care, you're working in the operating theater, is that by the time the patient gets to you, there's not really very much you can do about their smoking or their body mass index. And hopefully I'll come to that later about some of the interventions we're trying to look at. But anyway, smoking body mass index, and then the duration of the surgery. So so those were the 3 factors which came out as being statistically significant amongst our patients. On the next slide, I've got the specimens. And you can have a look there, and you can see it's mainly Staph aureus, which is, you would expect. That's that. Right, next slide. We did the same thing with the cost. We looked at what all the resources were in the exact same method as before, and we looked at just the additional cost, okay? So we said, what's the basic package of care that the commissioning trusts will pay for, and anything else on top of that which comes out of the hospital's profit, let's see the cost of the infection, what's that? And if you go on to the next slide, okay, we've done it the same as before. We've divided it up into acute care costs, inpatient costs, and then the primary care costs, post-discharge. Now, breast is cheaper than colorectal. An infection in a breast is cheaper than a colorectal infection, as you can imagine. But you can still see there that the cost for every infected patient, the average cost, was almost £1,500. That's still quite a lot of money. And remember, it was 1 in 10 of women had these infections. Another thing you might notice on this slide here is if you look at the distribution between the acute care and the primary care, for the colorectal patients, the primary care trusts were picking up 15% of the additional costs, and you can see here that they're picking up 29%. So the cost has shifted a little bit here, but still this is a very interesting finding, especially for our PCT, who are very interested to see that. On the next slide, we did the same thing. We multiplied it by 3 to say, well, how much are we spending on this in 1 year? It's not as bad as the colorectal surgery, but you can still see £67,000. It's still, a substantial amount of money. And remember, we're not even touching on the distress and all the impact that this is having on the actual patients themselves. So let's look at the next slide, the implications for practice. There's no point in doing something if you're not going to do anything with what you find. So what did we do here at Leicester? Well, what we did was we continued and we expanded our surveillance program. And I've got to say, remember, part of the driver for this was, well, certainly the chief exec, when he found out how much it was costing, wanted to implement a surveillance program. But remember I said that our commissioning primary care trust have put targets in for us where there are financial restrictions, right? So if we don't meet these targets, they withhold payment, and that includes implementing surveillance programs and also reducing our infection rates. I've got down here the implement a rapid surveillance feedback system. We're just starting doing that. And I've got to say, when we fed the results from our pilot, you know, this surveillance program back to the theatre staff, they were absolutely shocked. They were absolutely shocked at what the infection rates and just, you know, were amazed. So whether that's had any impact on their changing their practice. But there are studies out there which have looked at the impact of rapid feedback systems, and they've reported that you can reduce your infection rates by about 25 to 50% just from having a surveillance program with a rapid feedback system alone without even implementing any changes to clinical practice. We have implemented a care bundle, which I'll show you on the next slide in a minute. And we have implemented a care bundle. I'll tell you about that in a second. We have also, as a result, reviewed our clinical practice protocols. So remember I said that we've taken away we've hid all the razors and we've brought out the clippers and we've got people to use those. And one thing I haven't talked about in this study, when we were looking at the breast surgery patients, we also looked at seromas. A seroma is a complication of breast surgery, and it's where you've taken out tissue. There's a hole left there, and that hole fills up with fluid, and it can become infected. But the hole fills up with fluid, and then the women have to go to clinic, and they have a needle inserted, and they have the seroma fluid aspirated. Now, that's a horrible thing. And we actually found that 40% of our patients had seromas, and they were turning up to have to the follow-up clinic, the post-op clinic, the seroma clinic it's called actually, they were turning up to the seroma clinic an average of 5 times to have their breasts drained, 5 times after surgery. Now that's just, you know, unbelievable. But what we realized was we did not have any clinical guidelines for when you should stick a needle in a breast to aspirate it or not. So one of the things we've developed as a result of this whole study is, you know, we've got some guidelines now in place, clinical guidelines for when to aspirate breasts. So you can see that the impact of this program is much wider than just a very focused look at surgical site infections. The risk factors, the specific risk factors for us in our trust, it was body mass index and smoking. Well, to begin with, we thought, well, there's not really very much you can do about that. But we thought that was a bit defeatist, so we are doing some things. We've changed all the letters that go out to the patients at pre-assessment, and we emphasize the importance of giving up smoking much more and the nutritional aspects. And what we've done is we've teamed up with some of our general practice practitioners in the community, and when women, for example, are diagnosed with having a lump and they've got a hospital appointment in a month's time, we've got some, it's like a little hit squad, and they go in and they try and get the patient to give up smoking just for the 30 days prior to surgery, okay? And we kind of get them then, some people are very keen, some you know, they want to smoke more because they're, you know, very nervous about the surgery. But that's a time for us where we can go in and with the hit squad and let's implement some anti-smoking stuff then. What else? Oh, yes. And then remember I said the problem we had with our VAC dressings. We're working much more with our community colleagues to try and deliver a seamless service, seamless delivery of service by working there. Now, let me take you on to the last slide. And the last slide, this is just showing you some of the things that we've picked up on the care bundle that we implemented. And we chose these headings because, A, they were recommended in the NICE, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence guidelines to reduce surgical site infections, or that we had a specific problem with it in our hospital. So you can see them there. There's nothing in there that's unfamiliar to you. But I think we can probably go even further than what we currently do. You can see PrEP solutions there. You might be familiar with a study which came out in the New England Journal of Medicine just last month, January. I've been a big fan of chlorhexidine for a long time, but there are very few studies which look at chlorhexidine versus iodine on a patient skin prep, looking at surgical site infections. But a lovely study came out last month, 850 patients, and it showed that patients in the iodine group, surgical site infection rate, I think, was about 16%, And in the chlorhexidine group, it went down to, this is a randomized control trial, in the chlorhexidine group, it went down to 8%, so practically a 50% reduction. So I'm very keen, you know, if we can get our surgeons all switching to chlorhexidine. Temperature, again, I don't think we do enough. We're not proactive enough in warming the patients actively before, you know, on their way down to theatres. I'd like to do some more stuff about that. And then with this is the one we've got at the Bay, you know, it's our staff that said, please include this. This is our no peak policy. Those of you who work in the wards, perhaps you're familiar with when the surgeons do their ward round on the next morning and they sometimes just peel that dressing back just so they can have a wee look and then pat it back down. So we have our no peak policy, and anybody who does that, then the nursing staff can report them directly to our medical director. So in summary then, I hope that I've shown you the benefits of conducting gold standard post-discharge surveillance. And if you conduct gold standard surveillance, then you should be able to identify a more valid rate of surgical site infections, which might be helpful in convincing your colleagues of the need to improve practice or even just to implement more surveillance. And you'll also be able to identify what the specific risk factors are for your hospital. Some researchers think that different procedures have different risk factors, which is quite an interesting thing. So you want to find out what are your specific risk factors for your hospital and your patients. And you'll also identify areas of your own poor clinical practice, which we found very helpful. And contrary to perception, I'm hoping that I've shown that post-discharge surveillance, it's not difficult and it's not prohibitively expensive. Now, perhaps you don't have the resources to set up a full surveillance program, but you could, you know, could you afford just a short program, just even for 3 months? Because that would still be sufficient to give you kind of a snapshot of the extent of the infections in your hospital. So thank you very much for listening, and I think I'll hand you back over to Debbie.
Thank you very much. Judith, thank you so much. That was absolutely fascinating. I have to own up that I have seen you do this presentation, a similar presentation previously on the NICE Surgical Site yeah. Infection Roadshow, and I just think it is completely amazing, the work that you did, just to show that actually it is a complete misconception that post-discharge surveillance is a lot of money for very little reward. So well done to you and your team. Thank you for an excellent presentation. I think one of the things that you mentioned actually that I think speaking as an ICN that now works for a commissioning PCT,
oh, yeah.
the driver is the sequin. Yes,
yeah.
it is expensive, or yes, there is additional funding that's required. But if you can actually get that as a sequin, that's extra money. So actually, if you can do it, you get a bit extra anyway
yeah.
that you wouldn't get if you don't do it. So, you know, it's kind of a bit chicken and egg, really, isn't
that's
it?
That's right.
So I think actually that's the way forward in getting more robust surveillance staff out there. There are a lot of ICNs who perhaps would challenge a band three doing it rather than infection control nurses, I'm sure, which would be another whole
oh,
interesting But thank you very, very much. Thank you to everyone that's joined us today. I hope you found it as fascinating as I have. I would just mention that if anybody does have any questions that they would like to pose to Judith, if you would like to email me at debbie@webertraining.com, I will happily forward those on to Judith and then get back to you as fast as our internet systems will allow. And I'm sure Judith will be delighted to take any questions that you have through that route.
Yeah.
So please don't hesitate to drop us a line if you have anything that you would like to ask Judith as a result of this presentation. And again, I was just, as a final word, say thank you very much, Judith, for a very, very interesting presentation. Thank you all for joining us today, and we'll see you at the next teleclass. Thank you, and bye.
Thank you.
Bye.